misery, but the crowd loud. This pumping rhythm is hitting. We wanna make it clear, we ain't scared. This is the vision we want. We want, we want, we want, we want, we want, we want, we want. Supporting human conditions, not free market propaganda.
And welcome to Project Censored Show. This is Anthony Fest sitting in today for Peter Phillips and Nikki Huff. Our topic today, scandal at the Veterans Administration hospital system. Yes, you heard about one such scandal last year. We're going to talk about another one, sexual assaults covered up, assaults continuing. That'll be our topic today. Please stay with us. And again, welcome to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Anthony Fest, sitting in today for Peter Phillips and Mickey Huff. Peter and Mickey will return next week. Today we'll hear from two whistleblowers on sexual harassment and assaults in Veterans Administration hospitals. We're joined by Monisha Rios, a social worker. With her is an anonymous VA patient. We'll refer to her as Lisa, who will tell us what happened to her inside the VA system. Later in the program, joining us for the second half of the show will be Sarah Darashori, senior counsel in the U.S. Program for Human Rights Watch. She researches and advocates on issues related to the handling of sexual assault cases in the U.S. Thanks for joining us today. And let me introduce Monisha Rios in the studio. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
And again on the phone, we have an anonymous VA patient. We're referring to her as Lisa for this program. Lisa, welcome to the Project Censored Show.
Thank you.
Let me begin with Monisha. Please set the stage for us here. I mean, some listeners who have not been in the military may not be aware of the scale of the Department of Veterans Affairs, which became a cabinet-level department in the 80s. Department of Veterans Affairs has a budget over $150 billion. It runs over 170 medical centers and over 700 clinics. Monisha, do you know offhand how many patients the VA system serves in a year?
I don't. I do know that there are thousands upon thousands of us who, as we come in and out of service, go in and get care.
And I should add, you yourself are a veteran.
Yes.
Which branch of the military were you in?
Army.
I see. And of course, last year, during the summer, the scandal broke about the denial of care, we effectively call it that. Worst cases happening in Phoenix, Arizona at the VA center there, and it was said that nearly 40 veterans died while awaiting care, and the appointment records were falsified to try to cover this up. And there were similar, though perhaps on a slightly smaller scale, similar problems at the facilities in Wyoming and in Colorado. But this is yet another scandal afflicting this department and the people it's supposed to be serving. So Monisha, give us a thumbnail sketch of the scale of the problem, if you can.
All right. Well, in terms of my own experience, I've been in the VA system now for around a decade, and I've been serviced at four different locations. And at each location, I've experienced sexual harassment, threats of assault, cover-ups, and retaliation when I reported these events. There were a few instances where staff members did try to come to our aid, and even they were thwarted in their efforts. So in my advocacy work, I get to meet and get to know thousands of other veterans, most of them women, who have all reported some sort of harassment or groping or something worse, sometimes even rape, at the hands of other veterans who are being serviced at the VA, as well as staff and medical professionals that are there.
So it would be no exaggeration to say this is pervasive throughout the VA system.
That would be correct.
You mentioned going to four different facilities. Were they in different parts of the country?
Yes. One in Florida, one in West Virginia, Delaware, actually two in Florida. Mm-hmm. So And from what I hear through social media and all of these advocacy groups I belong to, it's all over the nation.
Give us the names of a couple of these groups, if you would, and websites.
Sure. The main one is the social media platform for a documentary called Service, When Women Come Marching Home. And we have a couple thousand members that actively participate, and then we have about 80,000 silent observers who follow the page, and that includes people at every level, congresspeople, people who work in the VA, and so on. And we use that platform often to try and raise awareness about these issues.
And presumably most of those 80,000 are veterans.
Presumably.
Mm-hmm. Okay, let's bring Lisa into the conversation. Again, Lisa is a pseudonym we're using for this patient who wanted to remain anonymous because she is still receiving treatment at a VA facility. She told us it was okay to say this much, that she is on the East Coast and that she did two stints in the Army, one in the late 70s, one from the mid-90s up until fairly recently in this decade. Lisa, thanks for joining us on Project Censored.
Thank you for having me.
Well, tell us about your experience, if you would.
Well, I was sexually assaulted in the military, so I sought out treatment at this facility on the East Coast. And while I'm being treated there, I was sexually harassed one time by a fellow veteran in a therapy group, and the second time by a fellow worker. And when I say worker, I'm a volunteer there. And the first time, since I had no faith in the system, I tried to take care of it myself. And that did work for a while. And then I eventually had to go to the therapist, and the therapist took care of it. Whether or not that'll work for the long run, we don't know. And then the second one, I took to the police. But it took me months to take that to the police. Actually, it took me about a year because, you know, you're working with this person, so it became difficult. But I took it to the police, along with the therapist taking it to police and other people taking it to the police, and nothing was done. He was never told anything about the charges that should have been brought against him.
This being your fellow veteran?
Yes.
And for clarification, of course, people may not know, but the VA has its own internal police force, and that's the police force you're referring to, not
yes,
local police
correct.
Or county sheriffs, but the VA's own police force. And you say they did nothing?
They took the report, but they never contacted the predator.
And they never got back to you?
No. They told me they were going to take care of it, but they never did.
And how much time has passed since then?
That was done in April of last year.
So it's safe to say probably they're not intent on doing anything.
It's a mute point at this point, you know. And I see him, you know, on a weekly basis, so.
He's still there?
Yes.
Not only did the VA police do nothing, but I wonder if he's even in contact.
And because of this, I've been, you know, it's caused me to change my volunteer job, so I'm away from him. And so it's caused me, the victim, to change what I want to do as a volunteer, and that's not the way it's supposed to happen.
What about the treatment you've received at the VA? What can you tell us about that?
My therapy treatment for my mental health is fine. My my primary care doctor triggered me early on because I was sexually assaulted in the military, and when I had my examination, she hurt me, and I told her to stop, and she did not. So she triggered me. Like I felt like I was being assaulted again.
Triggered?
Triggered, yes. In other words, I was feeling like I was being raped again. That's what triggered me.
While being examined by a female doctor?
Yes. Actually, she's a physician.
I see.
Assistant. She's not a doctor. But the key point being here is that she was told to stop and she didn't. And I reported that also, and I asked to be changed to another doctor, and that never happened either.
This is remarkable.
Well, and Manisha knows, the two of us, we took all of this stuff up to the chief of staff, and I'm getting good treatment now, but it took me to whistleblow to get good treatment.
When you say the chief of staff, at what level is that? Of the VA system?
Of that specific facility.
I see.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Which, of course, you should not have had to do in the first place.
No.
No. The patient advocate should have taken care of it, quite frankly, but none of this should have had to be done.
That's what I was going to ask you. Is there some kind of patient advocacy nexus within the VA? Does each large medical center have somebody who says, I'm here for you?
Yes, well, there is, but that person's completely overworked, and when it gets from the complaint to whoever is supposed to be doing something about it, it just falls through the cracks. I mean, when I requested, or anybody requests to get a new provider, it goes elsewhere. At least the patient advocate goes elsewhere, and those people are supposed to get the provider for the patient. Well, if they don't do their job, somebody else is supposed to be taking them to do their job.
So it seems from your experience, the patient advocate is both overworked and has insufficient authority.
Exactly.
I would agree with that statement
Manisha
as well.
Manisha is, yeah. Mm-hmm. So Manisha, have you heard many stories like Lisa's?
Yes, unfortunately, I have. There are many who've come forward and told me about being raped by VA MDs and years back. So this has been an ongoing issue for quite some time, and it does relate to the phenomena of military sexual trauma. So sexual harassment, assault, and rape on active duty, those perpetrators who are not properly handled in that arena leave with their benefits, go get care in the VA, and continue to perpetrate. And so those of us, I myself am a survivor of that as well, when we go to get care to relieve the aftermath of what we've suffered, we're subjected yet again to the same exact kind of trauma and the same exact kind of system that covers it up and wants to ignore the problem.
So you go back to civilian life and you leave the military and go to medical care from the VA, but the phenomenon carries over.
Correct.
Let me remind listeners, this is the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Anthony Fest, sitting in today for Peter Phillips and Mickey Huff. I'm speaking to Manisha Rios and to an anonymous VA patient we're calling Lisa. We'll continue our conversation after this music break. Welcome back to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Anthony Fest, sitting in today for Mickey Huff and Peter Phillips. The topic today, sexual assault in the military and after the military in the Veterans Administration healthcare system. My guests are Manisha Rios, a social worker, and an anonymous VA patient we're calling Lisa. Lisa, tell us more about how you've tried to go through channels to resolve your problem and what's happened or hasn't happened. You've already said you've tried to go through the VA police and there were no consequences.
Well, I mean, other than that, I've gone to the supervisor. The supervisor's, you know, what can we do? I had a friend that worked there that was being sexually harassed by a coworker and went to a supervisor, and the supervisor said, "What do you expect?" And so that person quit.
And, what do you expect?
Yeah.
Yes.
Because you're female, what do you expect?
Yes, and she was young, and of course I'm older, and I'm, you know, and I said, "You need to take this to the police." And she said, "What are they going to do?" And, you know, she didn't know my story, but I tend to agree with her. But what are they going to do? You know, yet sexual harassment is a very high priority on the VA list, so we are told.
And the supervisors, you say, throw up their hands and say, "What can we do?"
That's what that supervisor said. And the supervisor of this particular one that I was dealing with said that there was nothing she was going to do.
As if these assaulters are not under their jurisdiction, as if they weren't the supervisor.
It's acceptable behavior. It was acceptable behavior when I was in the military, and it's acceptable behavior on the outside.
When we... I'm sorry.
Yes, go ahead, Manisha.
Go ahead.
When Lisa and I sort of realized we were experiencing similar things and that we weren't the only two people in that specific facility also experiencing these issues, not getting results from going through the proper channels of reporting, we went to the senior executive staff and requested that they see us because this is a human rights issue. This denies us the care that we need and that we earned. And one of the major fallouts from this happening all over the place is it's a barrier to care. And as a social worker, I see this often where fallacies within the system lead to people not accessing the care that they need. And we see a large number of suicide. I'm not going to say it's a direct result, but in some instances it's possible. And as an indirect result, people are not going to the VA. Women especially are not going to the VA because I don't want to sit in the waiting room and get hit on and harassed. That's happened to me. I've been followed to and from appointments. I've been followed to my car. I've been threatened to have my teeth kicked in for getting a veteran in trouble by complaining to staff that he was following me, giving me love notes and things like that. And it's really it's just a huge, huge, huge problem that leads to very, very dire consequences for its victims.
And as we said a moment ago, it seems to be pervasive, and the more accounts you give us, the more clear that is. Let's back up a moment. I forgot to ask you earlier. The VA healthcare system is probably the only healthcare system for most veterans. Is that correct?
The only affordable one, mm-hmm. depending on your disability rating and what you're eligible for. So it's a never-ending, it's a race that we run.
Yes, go ahead, Lisa.
Well, that's another issue that you could have another hour on is our disability system.
Mm-hmm. But one thing I wasn't clear about was that if you leave the military, you're eligible for VA care, whether you sustain some injury or not, or no?
No.
Yeah, it depends on your income. It depends mm-hmm. on your disability rating.
And how long you served and what type of discharge you had. And
the soldiers getting off active duty right now have 5 years of care. There's a whole bunch of different situations.
Yeah, it's different from generation to generation and from era to era. So I was Persian Gulf era, so my eligibility is much different and more limited than, say, someone who is recently discharged from the current era, the post 9/11 era, as they now call it. So,
But you don't get lifetime care.
If you're lucky enough to be disabled enough,
oh.
Sure.
If you come out comparatively unscathed, then you you get a specified number of years of care, and then you're on your own again?
Yeah, and it really depends on the facility. There's this myth that all VAs are the same and that all policy is implemented the same on the ground, and that just isn't happening. It depends on how the individual servicing you in that moment interprets their job and the law on what you have access to and what you don't.
So give us an example of that, if you would.
Sure. So when I transitioned from the VA hospital in Florida to the VA hospital in West Virginia, I found that certain things I suppose the right term is entitled to in Florida, I was no longer entitled to in West Virginia. They didn't have the same type of care that I was receiving. So the continuity of care got messed up. And then when I transitioned from West Virginia to Delaware, I was in a very similar situation where I was told, yes, you can have access to this service. But when I went to go access that service, such as eye care or dental, then in that clinic, I was told something completely different and turned away. So it's very confusing for the veteran.
This is uncanny. I mean, this scandal of non-care and falsification of records in Phoenix came to light last summer, and the Secretary of Veterans Affairs, Eric Shinseki, took the fall for it, although whether he knew about it is debatable. But that's how things work in Washington, apparently. The higher-up has to resign, and then it's appearance, at least, of a fresh start when someone else is put in charge. But, of course, what was done at the lower level. By the way, Manisha Rios, what can you tell us about that, the scandal in Phoenix?
I heard about it the same way that everyone else did. And I thought it was interesting the way that it was received by the public and officials, that this was some sort of new thing happening, when those of us who've been going to the VA for a long time have known that these things were happening and have been talking about it and trying to get people to pay attention to us and, you know, all these other issues that go along with that. But it seems like now that it's suddenly in mass awareness, that it's treated as if it's a new problem, and it's not. None of these are new problems.
Are you aware of similar things going on at other VA facilities?
Yes. I experienced the long wait times on the East Coast. I experienced being told I was accessing too many services that I needed and that I'd had at other VAs. My healthcare has declined because I haven't received the same level of care that I earned and broke my body to get, you know. So a lot of people, especially rural veterans, suffer greatly. There's a lot that's not yet uncovered.
Mm-hmm. And what about you, Lisa? What can you tell us more broadly about your experiences with VA healthcare?
Well, I know for certain that the VA I go to is they do make appointments, and then they call you up a couple days before and cancel them so that the records show that they made them within the 30 days. So this skews their records. And this is where you get the scandalous numbers.
To hide the fact that people aren't getting care.
Exactly. And, you know, and I do know that people aren't getting doctors within a year.
A year?
Right.
But with what sort of issues have they tried to get appointments for?
All sorts of things. I mean, it especially since Obamacare came into, and now people are going, oh, I need insurance. And they're never used the VA system, and now they're trying to get into it. You know, some people have been using civilian insurance. They were entitled to VA insurance, but they never used it because they had some other insurance. Now insurance is expensive, so they want to come into the VA system, which you can't blame them.
And they're being told no?
They're not being told no. They're being told, some of them, if you're eligible, okay, we'll get you a doctor, but there's none available. So they're being told, okay, we'll get you a doctor within 30 days, and then your 30 days comes up, and they set you up another appointment.
Now, both of you are, of course, dealing with the VA at the ground level, but do you have thoughts on what's going on? What's really going on here? Is it a matter of an insufficient budget or what?
I think that there's
There's plenty of money.
Yeah.
Definitely. I do know that. There's plenty of money. It's not a money issue.
There's
not enough people.
It's being misdirected. The resources
exactly. have
being misdirected.
Exactly. And every time I turn around, there's a vacancy somewhere. There's not enough people, and people switch jobs. And but as far as healthcare and physicians, and there's not enough. They can't keep them. I have no idea, because they only work 9 to 5, or I shouldn't say that, 7 to 5, and only Monday through Friday. So
perhaps they're leaving for better paid work elsewhere?
I don't know. I think they get paid pretty good.
It's a traumatizing environment, and we're a very unique population.
So it takes
a certain level of training and a certain level of personal ethic and conviction to work with us, being on both sides of that fence, being a social worker and a veteran. I sort of see all the different cogs in the system that are at work here, and there are many different ways to improve it, and it's improvable. That's the tough part, is that it's frustrating to see it functioning the way that it is and failing people the way that it is, when it doesn't have to be that way. And it's really simple to fix these things. It just takes the individual human beings that are involved, that are in the positions of power, to decide how we are treated, to get their head back in the ethical game, and listen to the people who are closest to the problem, which is the people who are suffering from it. We have solutions to put on the table, and no one seems to want to take them seriously.
Let's discuss those solutions later on the program. But for right now, before we run out of time for this segment, let's ask Lisa if there's more she wants to tell us about her experiences in VA care.
I don't believe so.
So in summary, to summarize your case, you were assaulted while you were in the Army, and then you came out and went in for VA care, and then were harassed at VA facilities.
And then nothing's done about that.
And alas, we know, from news accounts of the many instances of assault within the military, many of which never are punished. And so to come out of that and then to go into the VA for the care for that, and then you get the same treatment in the VA system, that is scandalous.
Right, and then you wonder why, we wonder why women aren't coming to the VA, and that's one of the reasons. The women that are seeking out mental health is for that reason. They've been sexually assaulted.
And of course, that perhaps is an entire another story.
Yes.
Women who ought to be seeking health care but aren't doing so.
Correct.
That's very well. Well, Lisa, thank you for joining us today on the Project Censored Show.
Well, thank you for having me.
And we're going to continue with Manisha Rios, and we're also going to be joined by Sarah Darashori of Human Rights Watch. And we'll resume the second half of the program right after this music break. And welcome back to the Project Censored Show. I'm Anthony Fest, sitting in today for Peter Phillips and Mickey Huff. Peter and Mickey will be back next week. Our topic today is sexual assault within the Veterans Administration healthcare system. My guest is Monisha Rios. She's continuing with us for the second half of the program. We're also joined on the phone by Sarah Darashori. She's a senior counsel in the U.S. program at Human Rights Watch. She researches and does victim advocacy on issues related to sexual assault in the U.S. Sarah, thanks for joining us.
Well, thank you for having me.
So tell us a little more about your portfolio there at Human Rights Watch.
So Human Rights Watch, we generally investigate and expose serious human rights violations. And while we're mostly known for our work internationally, we also have a program that's dedicated to doing work in the U.S. And I personally have been focusing on sexual assault issues for the past few years. And so my last work or serious research was on police handling of sexual assault cases in the District of Columbia. And then after that project concluded, I ended up looking again at this issue of military sexual assault and found a number of issues, one of which relates to the VA.
Give us a sense of perspective, if you would. Tell us what you learned from that project of looking into the police treatment of sexual assaults in the District of Columbia. That might be a point of reference for this topic.
Okay. So in researching, essentially, Human Rights Watch had a while ago done some reporting on the backlog of rape kits in a number of places. And when I began to look at that issue, what surprised me was that the victims would go to the hospital for a four-hour exam and that police wouldn't even bother taking it to the lab. And when I talked to experts, they said, really, the problem is that the police aren't investigating sexual assault cases, that they dismiss them out of hand. So that's the reason for the backlog is just one symptom of a larger problem. So when I looked at D.C., I found that in fact, there are various reasons why D.C. was a good choice for a particular pilot project. But essentially, in speaking with survivors and advocates and nurses, we found that victims who reported were treated very insensitively, and they were subject to a lot of victim blaming when they reported, and that a significant number of cases were never investigated. We found about a third of the people who went to the hospital and underwent a four-hour forensic exam and reported to police at the hospital had their cases classified as miscellaneous, and that meant that they were never investigated by police, nor were they counted in their statistics for sexual assault. And unfortunately, that's a problem that has cropped up over the years, most recently in New Orleans, but also it's been in Philadelphia in the past, St. Louis, Puerto Rico. I mean, it's unfortunately not an uncommon problem.
Project Censored broadcasts from the San Francisco Bay Area, and it's been in the news here as well with the San Francisco Police Department rape test kits that were never followed up on.
Yes. Unfortunately, some of these old attitudes about sexual assault persist, decades after. I think there's been some shift in understanding about what the actual dynamics of sexual assault are, and that affects the police, and they're the gatekeepers to the justice system. So if they still hold on to attitudes about victims lying, then they shut down access to justice for people at the front gate when they're reporting, even though, now there have been a number of studies that show that false reporting rates for sexual assault are 2-8%, which is basically the same as for other crimes. And yet, when police officers are surveyed, there are a number of them. In a recent survey, I think, showed some police departments in the South that about half the police officers believe that half of victims were not telling the truth when they reported. So it's this persistent myths about sexual assault.
So if an investigation is never completed, then the district attorney can never bring charges.
That's right.
Tell us now about the work you've done, sexual assault and harassment within the VA system.
Yes. So essentially what happened was after the project in D.C., we had looked at doing some work on the military sexual assault issue a while back. But initially, I thought this would not end up being a project for Human Rights Watch just because there's been so much media attention already around this issue, and we usually look for issues that haven't yet been exposed. So, but I went back to speak with some organizations that work with service members, and what I heard was, you know, sexual assault cases are very hard to pursue, even in the best of circumstances when things are being handled well. And so very few people, unfortunately, see justice for these crimes. But most people who experience sexual assault experience some form of retaliation. And there's very limited options because the service members are not able to sue the military under Supreme Court case law. They are stuck with administrative remedies that exist within the military to deal with retaliation, and none of those seem to work. So most people who report sexual assault end up leaving the military, and ultimately there still seems to be, for victims, a choice between staying in the military and not reporting, or reporting and leaving the military. But the thing is, when I started investigating that issue, when I started talking to survivors, and now I've talked to about 140 military sexual trauma survivors, I discovered that the problems were really complex, that you have the issue of retaliation, which is ongoing and incredibly pervasive. I mean, the Department of Defense's own statistics show that 62% of people in their surveys report experience, you know, retaliation after reporting a sexual assault, but a much smaller percentage actually see justice for those crimes. But when I talk to people about their experiences with retaliation, almost invariably part of their trauma came from their experiences with the VA. And so we decided to do a series. Now we're going to do a series of reports. It ended up being that, you know, that there's quite a lot of issues that still need some attention. But the VA was definitely an issue that came up repeatedly with so many people that we spoke to as a problem. And the problems were ranging from, you know, feeling uncomfortable going to VA hospitals because it's essentially a military-like environment staffed with veterans. And as I'm sure you've heard from Monisha and Lisa, the environment can be pretty hostile. There's also actually a Government Accountability Office study that shows the pervasiveness of sexual assault at VA premises, which was surprising. And I believe there are sexual harassment and issues as well. But a lot of the problems that exist in the military are carried over into the VA system. But for survivors to go into that environment can be a triggering event for them and cause additional trauma. And for male survivors, too, we found that it's very hard for them to get support from the VA, that a lot of times the VA's outreach on sexual assault is for women and not so much for men, and that they're, you know, offered groups of PTSD survivors, others with male PTSD patients who have it from combat, and they don't feel comfortable being in a group with people who have experienced, who have PTSD as a result of combat. So they end up not getting the care that they may need. And it's so hard to get people to come forward and seek that care anyway, that to not have it available when people are looking for it is really troubling.
Given the nature of these offenses, probably statistics are hard to come by, but have you managed to, in your investigation, obtain any numbers or estimates of the scale of this problem?
The problem relating to sexual harassment or sexual assault in the VA?
Yes.
Or, okay, we're trying to pull down a number of different numbers. I don't think we've been able to yet, although we're still a ways away from finalizing our research, and we've been collecting data from the VA itself. But we haven't yet been able to put numbers on this particular problem. I mean, there were some numbers that were published a few years ago, which I should have reviewed, actually. I'm sorry.
Of course.
before this call. Indicated there were hundreds. I think there were like 300. I don't know. I can't remember whether I talked about this with Monisha, and she has a better recollection. Sexual assaults reported on VA premises over a couple year period, which seemed, you know, just like a lot.
Monisha Rios, do you have anything that can put a numerical metric to this problem?
Unfortunately, no. This is one of those those things that really is difficult to measure. So in the social sciences, we often rely on these sort of demographics and recovering this data. And there's no way to really know when it's not safe to report, when people don't come forward. But I think the last conversation Sarah and I had about this, the numbers were, I think you're on target, Sarah, with your remembrance, that is, there are fewer reports because they're not handled properly. And so the numbers aren't ever going to reflect the reality of the situation.
So many victims are going to say, well, it wouldn't accomplish anything anyway. What can I do?
Right.
And there never will be a report.
Right.
Let me remind listeners, this is the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Anthony Fest. I'm sitting in today for Peter Phillips and Mickey Huff. They'll return next week. We're talking about sexual assaults within the military and within the Veterans Administration healthcare system. And we'll be right back in a moment. And welcome back to the Project Censored Show. I'm Anthony Fest, sitting in today for Peter Phillips and Mickey Huff. We're in the second half of a one-hour discussion of the problem of sexual violence and harassment at the Veterans Administration healthcare system. My guests are social worker Monisha Rios, and we're joined as well by Sarah Darashori of Human Rights Watch. So, Sarah, if you would, continue, please, and tell us where your report is at, what stage.
So we're actually, our first report is due for release in April. And that report really focuses on retaliation against active service members and ongoing issues relating to sort of the lack of whistleblower protections and access barriers to mental health care for survivors in the military. The second report will look at wrongful discharges. You know, over many, many people who report end up leaving the military. Oftentimes they're pushed out for administrative reasons, using mental health in particular as a reason. And that was exposed a while ago, that the military was misusing personality disorder diagnoses to rid itself of, you know, people that they viewed as problems or people who might have had PTSD, but certainly didn't have personality disorder and shouldn't have gotten kicked out. But then that the result of those discharges is that it denied people benefits, and it's deeply stigmatizing and has a huge impact on their lives going forward because they have to show these papers when they're applying for jobs and for various other things. And it may mean that they can't get any benefits that they might really need to recover from the trauma that they experienced in the military. And while that problem has been...
Let me break in for a second. What kind of discharge is that?
So that's an administrative discharge, and sometimes it's under general conditions, which means that, which also has some limitations in terms of what benefits people can access afterwards.
And it's also something that will perhaps raise eyebrows in the personnel department of a prospective employer?
Absolutely.
Sort of like having been fired from a previous job.
Yes, yes. And that problem, I mean, and it has other impacts as well. I've talked to survivors who desperately needed, you know, back surgery, who were told, oh, well, this is all in your mind because I can see on your discharge papers you have a personality disorder. I mean, all kinds of unanticipated, really harmful, damaging consequences as a result of this discharge. But the problem is the only remedy for that kind of discharge is going to the Boards of Correction of Military Records, and that's an administrative body that each branch has that is supposed to review cases. But as a practical matter, they spend almost no time looking at cases or reading the files. No one has looked at these boards for years, and they very rarely change records in the military. And so that's the second study will really sort of look at essentially the problems people face as a result of having these discharges and the lack of remedy available within the existing military system. So we'll be seeking to improve that. And then the third report, so now I think we're actually probably in early 2016, we'll look at the VA and more specifically and make recommendations for improving care, access to care, more trauma friendly, the appropriate best practices essentially for caring for people and also giving options to people to seek care outside of VA hospitals if that environment is one that is damaging to them.
Well, we'll come back to you in a moment to ask about the audience you hope will review those reports. But as you were speaking about people being improperly discharged and improperly diagnosed, Manisha Rios was nodding. Would you like to interject something on that, Manisha?
Sure. So when I reported some of the things I experienced while on active duty, I did receive some retaliation. I didn't get the right discharge. I was given an honorable discharge, which I'm absolutely grateful for. I should have been given a medical discharge. I should have been treated differently while I was in, so that way when I came out, I was refused care. I went straight to the VA in Florida and said, this happened to me when I was in the military, and I'm here to get help for it. That was in 1998. And the social worker I saw then asked me point blank, were you raped? And I wasn't. There are many other ways to assault someone besides penetrable rape. And I said, no, not technically. And she said, get out. You have no right to ask for any sort of help. And so 6 years went by where I was left untreated. And had I had a medical discharge, I could have had direct access to the kind of treatment I needed. I wouldn't have had to go 6 years with exacerbating symptoms and, you know, my life basically taken away, my ability to function taken away, and me not knowing what is going on with me. And so after that 6 years, I was finally awarded 20% disability rating, service-connected disability for my back and my asthma. And that is what got me in the door for what the real, you know, deal was PTSD. And even more time went on where the people in the VA didn't really pursue looking at all of those problems. So Sarah is right on point that the aftermath is really detrimental to people.
And you've uncovered yet another dimension to this scandal, if I think we made it clear we can call it a scandal now, is that improper discharges and the consequent denial of care. Not only do what goes wrong to those who are admitted into the VA, but some who ought to be in and aren't. So let's go back to Sarah Derashori with Human Rights Watch, and let me ask you, who do you hope will read your reports?
Oh, you know, we have a very targeted audience. So, I mean, we do public dissemination and have, and work with the media when we release our reports, because we find often that helps create pressure on the relevant actors to do what they need to do. But for our reports, I mean, definitely we'll be speaking with members of Congress as well as Department of Defense people and people in each of the branches. We've been communicating with them already on some of our findings, but we definitely have recommendations targeted for each of those audiences. And then, you know, specifically within the branches, we'll have, you know, very concrete recommendations for reforms, but we'll also want to see some legislative action as well. But before I forget, I wanted to say that I found the VA number that I was looking for, and essentially it was between January 2007 through July 2010 was what they looked at, and they found 300 incidents of sexual assault on VA premises. But as you suggested, and as Monisha was saying, the rate of reporting sexual assault is so low. In the military now, which is a huge improvement, it's at 25%, but it's actually usually much even lower than that. So the actual number is probably much, much higher. So that's one of the areas we'll be looking at more closely to see what kind of steps have been taken to address some of those issues.
We've got a little over 5 minutes left, and you spoke about Congress. There are Veterans Affairs committees in the Congress. They've been made aware of these things. Shirley, what have they been doing to date? Let's start with Monisha.
It's funny you mentioned that, because recently a fellow veteran advocate and I were in D.C. lobbying about these issues, and we were there for the Equal Rights Amendment rally and took the liberty of going into the House Committee on Veterans Affairs room and talking to some of the staffers and just trying to say, you know, who can we talk to about this and make the committee more aware of all of these other issues that don't seem to be on their radar. And so it's anyone who's ever gone in and been through that process knows it's really, you have to be persistent. But I've been pushing for my state legislator to pay attention. I spoke at the Library of Congress for a Disruptive Women in Healthcare event, asking the spouses of the Congress people who were present for that, you know, hey, this is a real problem. This leads to veteran suicide when you can't access the care that you need because you're too scared of getting raped when you go to the hospital. You know, this is a serious, serious problem, and we need to start talking about it and doing something about it. And I get the you know, standard glazed over eye, painted on smile, head nodding. So there's definitely a report like what Sarah and Human Rights Watch are working on will definitely add more power to our arguments.
And it's probably true nowadays that if you're a congressional staffer, you probably did not spend any time in the military, correct? You probably took a different path in life, and you cannot, you know, have no real world experience to understand the veterans who come to address the committee.
I wouldn't know.
Oh, there are definitely some veterans and staffers in some of the offices. But, I definitely think it's nice that we'll have, at the end of this, hopefully we'll have a, you know, in-depth research report that we can give to really powerhouse, feisty, great advocates like Monisha, that they can do, you know, that they can move the ball forward a little bit.
I'm curious, we may not have time for this question, but how are you doing your research into this problem, which in some ways might seem to defy efforts to quantify it?
Well, it's a combination of things. I mean, so a lot of it is interviewing people. So we do, you know, hundreds, literally hundreds of interviews, both with survivors about their experience, veterans about with their experiencing at the VA, so that we can really paint a picture of what's happening and how people are, what their experiences are. We also speak to, when we can, people who have worked in the VA or within the VA. We'll speak directly with VA officials more officially as well. And we also do Freedom of Information Act requests and gather whatever data and information we're able to get from directly from the Department of Veterans Affairs, as well as whatever we can find that's publicly available, and then we put it all together and in a report. And also, you know, the key thing, as I mentioned, is making recommendations for reform. So that's always a big part of our research, is trying to figure out what the way forward is.
Give us, in a nutshell, a few suggestions that you already see as being necessary reforms, albeit your reports aren't completed yet.
Oh, gosh. It's definitely early for our recommendations in this stage. But for the VA, I mean, one of the recommendations will definitely be to make what they call fee-based care more easily available for for veterans who need help and wish to seek help but want to do so at civilian facilities outside of a veterans hospital, particularly. The one good thing that we found in many places is vet centers, which are more informal facilities that can also treat people for military sexual trauma counseling. And so we'd like to see more use of that. In some places, every hospital is now required to have a military sexual trauma coordinator, but that person is not necessarily given enough time to do the work that they need to do to be effective in their job. So what we would be interested in standardizing the position and raising it to a higher level so that it's a significant position within the VA, and that they have, you know, the capacity and resources to do what they need to do. We'd like to see more services inpatient and also other types of services and outreach to male survivors of sexual assault. And I think we're going to be looking really at some of the best practices, things that have worked well in hospitals to reach out to victims and make them feel comfortable. I mean, the VA sometimes...
Okay, I'm sorry, we're out of time now, and that'll have to be the last word. This has been the Project Censored Show. I was speaking with Sarah Doroshuri of Human Rights Watch and my guest in studio, Phanisha Rios. I'm Anthony Fest, sitting in for Peter Phillips and Nikki Huff. Peter and Nikki will return next week. Thanks to our engineer, Erica Bridgmond, and we'll see you next time.
That Monday campaign is why you hear the same old things they claim, but change never came. It's a dirty game maintained by rain for capital gain. But my people getting tired of the pain and the shame. We're not commodities or cars that turn to global economy. We're the promise of a legacy, a spirit we're honoring. An anomaly to those who can't imagine a world without oppressive forces, slaving for almighty dollar bills.
Habitualized, alibis, disguise under the guise of democracy, politics, and the apocalypse. Got the skies looking ominous. So the ocean burned bright with waves full of poison. Genocide, wars, fall for little boys. And the weapons manufactured paid for by attacks on the bridges and the levees and the mines collapsing. All the prisons, build the capacity, citizens. And the times for the master thief, combine and conquer, steal a masterpiece. Open your eyes and realize what's happening. Time's running out to reach all potential fame. At the table, then you're probably on the menu.
We got that love, we flip our brothers and our sisters. We want.